Hello, welcome to Hacker Public Radio on Omroep on 104.7 FM. It is 3 o'clock and with me today is my good friend and co-host Ken Vellen.
Hello.
And today we don't have 5 guests, but we have one, but certainly not less than the last time. Our guest today is Bert Hubert from PowerDNS.
Hello.
Hello, Bert. Nice to meet you. Today I wanted to talk to you about DNS, and for the people who have no idea what I mean by the term, could you explain for them what it is we're going to talk about?
Sure. DNS is it's been called the phone book of the internet, and so whenever time you visit a domain name, you visit a website, you enter a name because people like entering names and don't like entering numbers or IP addresses. So DNS is the phone book that actually translates these names into the IP addresses, which saves a lot of remembering. If people ask, do I actually need DNS? You could not use the internet without it. So at most internet service providers, when they say our DNS is down for the average user, that means the whole internet is down. So DNS is, I think it's one of the most important parts of the internet. And what I like to tell people is that we're like the sewer of the internet. Very as nice. Long as it works, you don't know it's there. And when it stops working, you're in deep shit.
Okay. So the idea behind DNS, it's supported by all operating systems, even your mobile phone or whatever. And you want to go... Can you talk us through, I want to go to www.hackerpublicradio.org. What happens on your computer?
Yeah, actually... A tremendous number of things happen, and when you hear it, it's like, oh wow, it's amazing that it works at all, because the internet, there is no central place of the internet. Well, maybe it's here this week, but on the other side, there is no central place of the internet. So there's not one big list that says, well, here are all the domain names of the internet and here are all the IP addresses. That would be a very interesting place to be if you had that list. So DNS is the domain name system, but the D might as well stand for distributed. That means that it's all over the world. So if you ask, let's say you want to go to www.ohm2013.org, your phone, for example, will ask your internet service provider, do you have the IP address for me? And typically it will say, yeah, I do hear this. But let's say it didn't already know that IP address. It would have to start asking around the world to say, well... And let's start at the sort of central place. It's called the root servers, the root of DNS. There are now hundreds of these root servers, and some of them in the Netherlands, some of them in the US. They're everywhere, which is it's also interesting because if you own the root servers, then you own the internet. But we'll probably get to that. And then your ISP will ask that root server, do you have the IP address of ohm2013.org? And the root server will say no. I don't have that list, but here is the org servers. Here are the IP addresses of the org. And you can ask over there, and they will actually go there and say, well, do you know the IP address of ohm2013.org? And the org servers will again say, no, we really don't know that. But we do know the IP addresses of the ohm name servers. So go ask there. And finally, there the question gets repeated. What's the IP address of www.ohm2013.org? And you will finally get back the answer. This can take 25 packets for one question, and that's the amazing part, that it mostly works.
So on your own PC, you will get the DNS server that you talk to is the DNS server normally supplied by your router, which is normally configured by your ISP. So it will know your ISP's DNS server.
Yeah, there's a thing called a STUP resolver.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of all operating systems, so it's also in printers and in phones and in webcams and whatever. And this STUP resolver is a little library that doesn't really know a lot about DNS. It just knows enough to ask a question of your internet service provider. And internet service providers, they run this service for you, and they call it a caching resolver. So the story is your browser wants to know an IP address. It asks a STUP resolver. And the STUP resolver asks your ISP, and the ISP starts talking to all these servers around the world to actually figure it out.
So it's the first server that you ask is responsible for doing all the asking to the other servers.
Yeah, so in typically your own device, your own phone, will only be talking to your internet service provider.
Yep.
And the internet service provider will, on your behalf, go ask around the world.
So it'll first, presuming it knows the root servers because somebody's typed that in, or yeah, that came with the operating system.
Yeah, that's called the hints file.
Yep.
And there used to be 12 root servers, and the hints file was then used to ask any of these 12, do you know the current IP addresses of the root servers?
And they're responsible for all the top-level domains?
Yeah.
Not just the .coms,
no,
.orgs?
No, it's .com, .orgs, everything.
Yeah,
so,
and okay,
so the root is really where everything starts. So if you, let's say, you take .nl out of the root, then .nl disappears.
Ceases to exist.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, it's a powerful... I mean, the people that operate these machines, and they're actually not overly impressive machines. They're like one unit high, and you can just touch them, and it's like feeling the sort of the core of the internet. But then again, it's just a one unit high machine. Well, two of them typically.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, you mentioned earlier that in a bad case scenario, you can have like 25 packets going to and for from before you finally reach the answer. But for the regular people, how much time is that in seconds if you're lucky?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. It turns out that you can have 100 megabit or 100 gigabit internet connection, but if your DNS is slow, your whole internet will feel slow. Mm-hmm. So it's really important how fast your DNS is. And people find that when they change to a better name server, and we might get to that because it takes quite a lot of work to build a really high performance good name server. And I don't mean the software, but I just mean the taking care of it. But it typically a cache hit is in a millisecond or something like that. It's just like ping. So you ask a question, you get the answer. But if the answer isn't there, it can easily take 100, 200, 300 milliseconds. And during those 300 milliseconds, nothing else happens on your computer because everyone is just waiting for that IP address. So it really has a big... I think DNS right now is, because everyone has so much bandwidth, DNS is probably more the limiting factor in your browsing speed than the actual bandwidth is.
Yeah, and what people tend to forget is you go to a page like CNN.com and there are hundreds of lookups because there's ads, there's redirections, there's pictures from somewhere else.
Yeah.
All these need to be resolved.
Yeah, and actually the way it has worked is people outsource part of their hosting to like Akamai, for example.
Yeah.
And during that outsourcing, they also put a pointer in DNS that says, well, if you need this IP... Yeah, we're still alive. If you want to show this ad, then also go through the Akamai name servers, which also further delays things. So this is called a chain, a chain of lookups, a CNAME chain, and some of these chains are now 5 steps deep.
Yeah, and also I suppose we're... jumping the gun, the time to live on these will be relatively short because you're putting it to a name service and you want the lookups
So let's take a brief step back. Because a DNS can take 200, 300 milliseconds, we like to have caches. We like to have them around. Your operating system has a cache. Your ISP has a cache. Your browser typically also has its own cache. And these things are used to speed up the lookups. But if you know that you have a rapidly changing IP address, then you don't want it to be cached for too long. So that's called the time to live. And in the time to live, you can say, well, this answer is valid for a day, for example. Which means that after one lookup, the next lookup from that same server should come along only after 24 hours. But for some reason, people like to set the time to live at 5 seconds. which would make sense if you change your IP address every 3 seconds or something like that. But it's... If you look it up, it's an amazing amount of work.
Somebody actually sets it at 5 seconds.
Oh, they do all the time, and this is sometimes it's just a matter of not thinking. But there are also people that buy DNS-based load balancers, and those load balancers they just default to something, and well, let's stick with the default. So we had a very big Dutch web shop, Wekamp.
Yeah.
And Wekamp had their TTL at 0 seconds, and you wonder why, but. People do.
Okie dokie. Sorry, I'm okay. Shocked and stunned here. Shocked and stunned.
Yeah. Well, we already went a bit into what's inside the DNS record. It's the DNS system as a whole is something like a phone book. But what are the other attributes you can derive from a DNS entry?
Yeah.
What's the information that's usually accompanied with it?
Well, I'll first give the usual answer. The usual answer is the other big thing that lives in domain name system is where email should be delivered. So if you have an OHM 2013.org email address, then there will be names, or there will be mail servers associated with that domain, and that's then an MX record lookup in DNS, and that will tell the internet if you want to send email to these folks, then you need to use this mail server. So that's the other really big thing that's in there. Another big thing that's there is spam filtering information. So people can publish for IP addresses to say this IP address has been known to send spam. And you can look that up, and that's also stored in DNS. So these are things that lots of people know about that are stored in DNS. What is relatively little known is that any time you use your cell phone to sign on to the 3G or GSM or 4G or LTE network or whatever, there's a thing called an APN, which says those are the details for your internet service provider. And that's on your SIM card. And actually, that APN sometimes looks a little bit like a domain name. And that's because it is. So so next to the internet use of DNS, all mobile phones in the world, whenever you sign them on, deep from down in the firmware, it does a DNS lookup to figure out the details on how it should connect to the telephony infrastructure. And these are like very tiny DNS, very small DNS servers that each cell phone operator has to run one. And every time you turn on your phone, there's a little DNS query to that.
And you're going to talk to us about PowerDNS.
Well, I could talk about anything. But, okay. So the history is with my own history with DNS is PowerDNS. We started out in 1998, I think, when there were only two name servers in the world.
Bind being one, and
Bind, and the other was the TinyDNS, or DJB DNS. And at the time, we wanted to have a load balancing name server. Or you could say, well, we want to have the visitors from Europe go to a European IP address, and we want to have the visitors from the US go to a US IP address, and we want to solve that problem from DNS.
Okay.
And no one did that at the time. So then these were the .com days. This is when where you could start a company with a bad idea, and you would still get money. And actually, our idea was it was a bad idea because the world was not ready for commercial DNS, because we started out as a real .com that was not open source. And at the time, no one wanted, everyone used only open source DNS, so no one was ready for that. But originally, we started as a closed source software company with the goal of making this DNS-based load balancer. And the interesting thing, we never got around to actually writing the DNS-based load balancer. Sometimes you forget why you started something. And the DNS-based load balancing only arrived when the Wikipedia contributed that code to PowerDNS and moved to it. So for a very long time, the Wikipedia used PowerDNS to distribute queries around the world. And I think they still do.
Okay.
So PowerDNS is an open source name server. And it's it can run. And that's the unique thing about it, I think. That it can get its data from a database.
Okay.
So most name servers, if you have to edit a zone, you edit a text file. And I personally, I like editing text files. I have no issues with that. But if you have a million domain names, it becomes a bit unwieldy. I have a million text files. So we decided early on that we would be doing DNS directly from MySQL, PostgreSQL, or Sybase, or whatever. And to this day, that's really what we're best known for doing that. Yeah, that's PowerDNS.
When did it become open source, and what license is it under?
We did that, I think, in 2001. And we then went for the GPL version 2.
Okay.
And for a reason I don't quite remember at the time, we decided to stick with version 2.
Okay.
And I sometimes feel a little bit bad about that, because GPL 3 probably has some advantages for us. But at the time, we thought, well, the standard licensing theme that is in software programs is that this software is licensed under the GPL or any new versions that the Free Software Foundation releases of the GPL, which effectively hands a blank check to the Free Software Foundation to come up with anything they can call the general public license.
Yeah.
So at the time we thought, well, this Richard Stallman, well, and I admire him very much as a sort of a saint, and but he's also a difficult person, and everyone knows that. And so at the time I was like, well, let's not hand him that blank check to be able to change my licensing terms without me knowing it.
Yeah, I think, and Linus had also made the same decision as well. So
yeah, but I think, but afterwards, but I cannot quite recall why I didn't like GPL3. But okay. But the decision was taken before the GPL3 was even on the horizon.
Okay. And who started the project? Who?
That was actually that I was the technical guy.
Yeah.
And we had an original sort of launching customer, which is called V3 Redirection Services, and they used to be known for having these nice URLs you had go to and come to and browse to and surf to.
Yeah, yeah.
And people could use that because if they got some web space from their service provider, it would have a really nasty name.
Yeah, yeah.
And registering domain names was tricky, so you could register come to Bert, and it would function like tinyurl.com does today and redirect for you. And those were the people that actually wanted to have a load balancing solution because they were acquired by an American company, and so that's how we that was a joint effort of V3. And actually, the original V3 guys are still shareholders in PowerDNS, but they're not involved in writing any actual code.
So there's a company behind this as well.
Yeah, there's
what's that company called?
It's called PowerDNS. Oh, that's that's very easy. It's known as PowerDNS.com BV because that was the time when people when they registered their company they actually called it .com.
Yeah. Okay.
And that company consists of very limited number of people, and we're all here.
So okay.
The entire company is at.
So if an asteroid hits, we're all screwed.
Yeah, and actually,
everyone's switching back to bind.
There is a sort of issue with that we actually sell 24/7 high-end support with 15-minute response times, which means that we cannot get drunk together.
Okay,
Or at least not so much that we can no longer provide support.
And don't worry, folks, I've all around the campsite, I saw fiber optic cables, so they're probably closer to the backbone of the internet.
No, we are able to support people from here. So we only had one support issue come up so far. This week.
Or ever.
No. We actually get questions.
And probably an interesting question for people is, you started as a closed source company, you opened up the keys to the kingdom, and yet you can afford to live in lavish lifestyle with your Ferrari outside and stuff. How did you make money from all of this stuff?
There's not a Ferrari.
It's a push bike.
No. But I think there's a very serious point in there. I think that the best open source is open source that's able to fund itself so that the developers have lots of time to work on the actual project. If you look at the statistics for the Linux kernel, for example, 80% of the Linux kernel is written by people that actually have a job, which means that they have to program on Linux.
Yeah.
And I strongly feel that it's very difficult, challenging to write open source in your high-quality open source in your spare time.
Yeah.
Because people they have a job during the day, they get home, they're tired, they have worked already, and then maybe they can squeeze in 2 hours of development, which is only possible if they don't have a family or other stuff that also wants to talk to them. So I think that it's that one of the, and that's also my talk for Friday. We succeeded in living the open source dream. We are an open source company, and we live from our open source projects, and we live quite well. And I think that is a model that other open source projects should seriously look at, because it allows you to devote serious time to your open source project.
Yeah. Okay. So, but the code is open. Where does the cash come from?
Well, I want to thank Microsoft for this. But it works like this. There was ingrained in people's memories a model that software costs serious money. And then on top of that serious money, there was a 15% maintenance fee to be paid.
Yeah.
That was the industry standard.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone knew that. And then in the open source world, software had always been free. So the software was free. And then suddenly Microsoft started to give away rather large pieces of software together with Windows. And they were able to For example, they at one point they started giving away media servers to companies doing serious broadcasting on Windows 2008, I think. And okay, free digital broadcasting infrastructure came along with that. But here's the interesting thing. The broadcasting organizations that worked with that said, well, thank you that it's free, but frankly, we don't care that it's free because we will be basing our business on it. We want you to guarantee that it works. We want to be able to talk to you, and if there's an issue, we want you to feel responsible. So what happened, it is no longer weird in the industry that software might be free. That doesn't change anything. If you look at the big telecommunication service providers like Verizon and those kinds of places, they don't care that the software is free. That doesn't matter at all. But they still want to pay for the guarantee that someone will pick up the phone if it breaks. And it used to be weird for people to be paying support for free software, but in very big companies, it's very normal these days.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And you have. Do you have any big companies that you can mention here that might be using the PowerDNS or not?
I'll give a list. Five companies, and three of them are using PowerDNS.
Okay.
So, and I can always deny that anyone. So that would be France Telecom, Deutsche Telekom, British Telecom, Verizon, and T-Mobile.
Okay. And some of those are using...
Some of those are actually using PowerDNS.
Okay, very good.
And some of them are actually also paying for it.
That's also quite good. I myself worked for a company who used PowerDNS, and it actually got a bad rap from a lot of people. But when you investigate the reason why, it was more to do with the choice of database, a MySQL database on the and replication issues with the MySQL database on the back end. And this was a long time ago, of course. What would you recommend for somebody starting out? What sort of database would be your personal favorite to use?
Yeah, I used to answer MySQL to that question. And to get back to your story, if the PowerDNS installation has an issue, then there is an issue. Then we could, of course, say, well, it's MySQL. But we need a database to function. So we do know that MySQL used to have issues with the replication. These days, I would probably recommend PostgreSQL for almost everything.
Yeah.
But replication, I don't think anyone is really happy with their replication setup.
Why not?
Well, if you ask people, you say, well, have you ever had your databases get out of sync? And everyone will say, that happened to me. And I had to resync, and it took ages. And so that's actually the So, for example, one setup I run is rather unconventional. I use SQLite, and I distribute my updates using rsync.
Well, you use SQLite?
Yeah, and it turns out SQLite is really fast.
Yeah.
And it's rock solid, and because it's just one flat file, I can rsync it across.
But is it not single thread? You're only allowed one connection. But then again,
No. You have to think hard about not getting locked in your own connection.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, but as long as you make sure that you don't lock yourself out of the house.
Yeah,
so to speak. Then there is no issue with it. So, I like that one. But we support MySQL, PostgreSQL, Sybase, MongoDB, and a whole array of other things, LDAP and stuff. So we sort of, as PowerDNS, we try to say, well, we support your database, and we don't say, well, this is the main one we support.
What sort of operating systems do you run on?
It's the usual ones. So we Linux, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD, Mac, most of the time.
No Windows.
No, we actually that is a very interesting. I think of it as a very interesting story. Every once in a while, we get the itch and we compile PowerDNS for Windows, and it's about a week of work. So it's doable. Windows has grown enough Unix features that it's no longer that hard to do. And when we do that, an executable comes out, and we tested it a little bit, and we asked it three questions, and it worked, and we put it online. This was around 8 years ago, and there have been, I think, 100,000 downloads of the Windows version, far more than ever have been of the Linux version. And even though it doesn't actually work, that executable, because it leaks memory like a sieve, so you have to restart it every 6 hours or something like that. There are people using it in full production. Because I think on Windows, people are used to software that sucks. For that reason, and then we removed that executable.
Yeah.
Because people said, well, yeah, you have it online, so you must be supporting it. So we took away the executable, and there is now a script out there that tries to download the executable every 15 minutes just to see if it's coming back.
Wow.
And that never sees. So at one point, I just briefly put the executable back to get that script off my server. But after a few weeks, it came back again. The Windows version, actually, no one does DNS on Windows. No one, even really, really super duper Microsoft shops. And I'm not an anti-Microsoft guy, but it's actually the case that even Microsoft doesn't do DNS on Windows. So it's not something that we really work hard at.
Okay. That's but do you have any requirements underlying operating system requirements? I mean,
yeah, we have a weird one. So PowerDNS is actually two products, or at least. So it's the PowerDNS authoritative server,
yep,
which you use to publish the phone book. And there's the PowerDNS recursor, which is the one that consults the phone book for you. So
yep,
an ISP would run the recursor for its customers. And the recursor made a choice to use some rather obscure Unix system calls, which almost no one uses, no one knows. They're called set context, get context, swap context, and make context. And they work very well, these calls. But because no one knows them, sometimes people forget to implement them. So, for example, on the ARM CPU platform, the Linux people decided not to implement get context, which means that for a very long time it was not possible to run the PowerDNS recursor on ARM. And after now, I think after more than a decade of this, someone added the required function call to libc. So it is coming now. But that's the only weird requirement we have. Otherwise, it's a very standard piece of software.
Okay. Would you recommend, is there any use for a home user to have a DNS server and run their own DNS?
Yeah.
Is that even allowed from ISPs?
There are a few really shitty ISPs that don't allow it, but they usually are truly shitty, so our esteemed audience will not be customers from such ISPs. Because they disallow it because they mess with your DNS to inject advertisements, kind of stuff. So it's not a hacker-friendly setup. There is actually a pretty good reason to run your own name server, and that's well, the privacy and security story. Name servers are widely used to inject advertising and other stuff, or hijack domains that don't work. And you may want to be in control of your own DNS. So that's one good reason. The other good reason is that many service providers that are not really paying attention run pretty shitty name servers. Overloaded name servers.
Yeah.
So it is quite quickly possible to run your own name server and have better performance than your ISP's name server.
Then all the requests will be going out and coming back via yours.
Yeah, that's true. But you probably, after one hour of browsing, everything you ever visited is in the cache.
Okay.
But it's true. The internet service provider's resolver should be faster.
Yes, in principle.
In principle, but quite often that's not the case. The current very best name server out there is actually Google DNS, 8.8.8.8.
Yeah, for no other reason than it replies to a ping.
Yeah, but it's actually they're the best. They just but then the issue is then you hand all your DNS, so then you hand the remaining bits of your DNS traffic to Google, exactly. The few pieces that they didn't see already. That's the downside of Google public DNS.
Okay. Do you support secure DNS at all?
Well, we do very much on the authoritative side.
Yeah.
For more than a decade, we told everyone that DNSSEC was too complex and over-engineered and hard to implement. And people confused that for that maybe we wouldn't be able to do it. But we honestly thought that DNSSEC was too complicated, and I still believe that. But then after 10 years, it became obvious that DNSSEC would become mandatory in many circles. So then after saying that it was shit for 10 years, then we decided, okay, but then if we have to do it, we're going to do the best and the easiest implementation we can think of. So in PowerDNS Authoritative, we now have Fire Up and Go DNSSEC. So it's literally one line, and then it does DNSSEC for you, for your domain. And we worked very hard with our biggest users to make it friendly to them. And what I find interesting result is that even after saying it for a decade that we found DNSSEC to be too complicated, we now have a 97% market share of DNSSEC.
Pretty impressive. Pretty good.
Yeah, and it is. And we have had a lot of help from friends to make that happen. But we also listened really well to our the users that wanted to do DNSSEC. So we worked really hard to make it incredibly easy for them. And in the end, what helped is that some of the registries, which are the national operators of DNS infrastructure, they decided to hand out money if you deploy DNSSEC.
Oh, okay.
And that convinced many of the biggest users. As an anecdote, one of the big Power DNS users in the Netherlands was able to buy a new brand new motorcycle from deploying DNSSEC. And that was why he was quite motivated to make that happen. So that's how you get a 97% market share.
Okay, yeah. Oh, fair enough.
Before we continue on the question, could you go into what DNSSEC is and how it works?
That's very good. So in the most basic sense, DNS is the phone book of the internet, and DNSSEC is sort of the phone book of the internet with an official stamp that the answer you got was the right answer. DNS by itself does not have any cryptography on it. So you get back an answer that says, well, this is the IP address of ohm2013.org, and good luck. And anyone could change that packet midway, and you'd never know that it has been changed. It's a plain text, unauthenticated protocol. And that didn't sit easy with people because they said, well, but it's so important, it's at the very root, at the core of the internet, so we also want crypto on that. So with, and then they said something else. They said, but we love DNS so much that we don't want to change it. And that's where it went wrong. DNS is incredibly flexible. You can put anything in DNS, and people have put anything in DNS. And so they said, well, we can just add the crypto to it. We'll just add a record type, and we call it key, and a record type, and we call it signature, and bam, and we're done. And then it turned out that everyone was in love with that idea. Everyone was in love that, wow, we built a protocol that's so flexible that we can just add the encryption to it later. Then they discovered that it wasn't actually true, that DNS didn't work like that because it would, for example, drop the keys because the cache expired first and that kind of stuff. So it was not possible to retrofit DNSSEC on DNS. And that's the point where people should have said, well, let's work on DNS too. Let's just start from scratch. Let's build something better than DNS and make it secure from the ground up. But that's not what they did. They sort of squeezed the crypto into DNS and had to change the rules, had to modify how DNS actually works. And out came this monstrosity called DNSSEC. And as an example of how monstrous that is, there are now queries you can ask on the internet, a very simple query that says, tell me everything you know about ICANN.org. And I think right now you get back a 4 kilobyte packet answer with 4 kilobytes of encryption on it. So to boil it down, it's a way to make DNS secure, but while it made it secure, the very security made these packets so enormous that they now are in themselves a security risk.
That's correct. I've had a complaint from somebody regarding my own name server regarding a request done towards the site of that very packet.
Yep.
Okay.
Why is this?
The problem. Let's make an example. I have a shitty. Let's say I would have a shitty internet connection at home.
Yeah.
And I would send out a few packets per second to Nido's name server, and I generate maybe 1 megabit of traffic. And now Nido's name server sends back answers that are 40 times bigger than my questions. So suddenly I turned my 1 megabit per second of queries into a 40 megabit per second stream of answers. In itself, that's not a problem because the answers are all coming back to me. So I just did a denial of service attack on myself. That's not that much of a problem. Now I fake my IP address. And I assume someone else's IP address And I send questions from someone else's IP address, and then at my 1 megabit per query rate comes back as a 40 megabit per second denial of service attack. And this is currently, this morning I was approached by a big name server operator, a big DNS operator, and he told me they now have 50 gigabits per second pipes, and they get filled with 50 gigabits per second of denial of service attacks.
Okay. How is it possible to spoof the IP address? Is it not a TCP connection?
No, DNS is UDP.
Oh.
And that's the part where I think that when I said we should have just done DNS too, and that's where we would should have changed that and have some kind of two-way handshake there in there.
Yeah. Okay.
But UDP it's currently fully connectionless. And actually the solutions that are being pondered right now are just saying, well, you should be doing TCP IP for DNS. And for a long time, everyone said, yeah, but that's too slow because UDP is so much faster. And the reason people said that was because there were no tools to benchmark that. There was no DNS TCP benchmarking tool. So everyone had just assumed that it was slow. And then when we actually wrote that tool to try it out, it turned out that DNS over TCP is not slow. And why is that the case? Everyone has been optimizing their servers for HTTP for the past decade. And the result of that is that in some cases TCP is now actually faster than UDP because it's so highly optimized. For example, Linux, if you send a UDP packet from Linux, it will send it sort of synchronously. It just drops the packet in the queue of the Ethernet device, and then it returns control to user space. If you do the same thing for TCP, it just copies the data you want to send to the kernel, and then your user space can get on with whatever it was doing. And in the background, the kernel will actually take care of the transmission for you. So it turns out that if you do DNS over TCP, you get lots more packets. That is true. You get like 6 times more packets. But your operating system is so well tuned for that that you can actually still achieve a very high query rate.
Okay. And that would solve the denial of service attack.
That would at least, that would improve it massively because that would disallow the blind spoofing going on right now. And I think that within this year, within the next 12 months, we will see a movement towards making people actually mandate that they support DNS over TCP.
Okay.
Because one of the denial of service mitigation techniques you can use is if you get a lot of queries over UDP, you send back one answer that says, well, the next question I need to see is over TCP. And if someone then doesn't come back over TCP, then you know that you are looking at spoofed traffic.
Okay.
But as it stands, people routinely deny port 53 on TCP for DNS because there are still the old guidelines out there that say that it's good for security to block DNS over TCP.
And a lot of people were using it as a transport to do tunneling over.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's also true. Yeah.
And, so that's kind of how that got blocked.
Yeah, we're going to lose in some way.
Yeah. But then again.
Do you have any idea where this recommendation came from to block TCP DNS traffic?
I think I do. DNS is the phone book of the internet, and like a phone book, you can make a copy of it, and this is called a zone transfer. Mm-hmm. And if you do a zone transfer of any interesting, recently I came across a zone from a rather big international corporation, and if you see that zone, then suddenly you see lots of domain names that you didn't know exist. So this manufacturer of printers turned out to have FTP servers all over the place. And you would not have known, but if you had downloaded the entire zone, you suddenly saw ftp.southafrica.blahblahblah.com. And, well, who knew? So if you're able to transfer a zone, you get a sort of map of IP addresses which you can attack. And the easiest way to block zone transfers is to block TCP, because zone transfers always happen over TCP.
Yeah.
And I think that's the origin of the recommendation to block TCP port 53.
A lot of companies block it as well because in the zone transfers they've got new projects,
exactly.
New products. Yeah.
So but the thing is, that you can also block the zone transfer just from the software.
Yeah.
You don't need to block it on the firewall.
Yeah, but true enough.
Yeah, but any auditor, I mean, it's probably it's still being copy pasted in manuals that We also had that issue with Cisco default configurations. I think for half a decade, everyone told Cisco, update your default configuration because it blocks DNSSEC. It blocks secure DNS. But Cisco is apparently big enough that even if lots of people within Cisco are trying to change the manual does not change. And finally, it took some senior vice president there to just put his foot down. And now finally, if you take a default configuration, it will no longer block DNSSEC, but it might still block port 53 for all I know on TCP.
Okay.
Let's see. Can we talk a bit more about the databases and how PowerDNS makes use of those?
Yeah, that's a good one. DNS, a typical the kind of query rate that people care about in DNS is in the order of 10 or 20,000 queries per second. Big operators like to be able to do that kind of DNS query rates. You can go far higher, but I think most people feel comfortable with 10 or 20,000 queries per second. Each DNS query can translate into 3 or 4 or 5 database backend queries. That has to do with looking up wildcards and CNAMEs and other things. So that means that that's use a factor of 4, that you're quickly looking at 60, 70, or 80,000 database queries per second. Most databases get very unhappy if you do that. It's not what they like. So because of that, we have our own internal database caching engine. So we try to make sure that we don't keep asking the name server the same the database the same question all the time. And using this mechanism, which is database independent, so we do it for all our backends, we are able to break down those 5 queries to maybe 1 on average. And this allows us to achieve serious query rates on top of a database that itself would not be wanting to supply that. And the most important things we block are queries that actually have no answer. Because if you ask a database for a record that doesn't exist, that is almost by definition the hardest amount of work that has to do, because it actually has to look everywhere to see if the data actually really doesn't exist. So we block both the we cache both the presence of data and the absence of data.
Okay. Let's see.
That would be obviously there'd be one lookup where it says it's not there, and then you maintain that for how long?
Well, that's configurable.
Yeah.
And the question, of course, was for example, we have one very big user that is under a denial of service attack a lot, and they have set their cache TTL at 1 day.
Okay. Yeah.
But the problem, of course, with that is that you get very little traffic to your database. But if you make any changes to the database, no one would know about them. However, we have a very a powerful infrastructure where you can do selective cache invalidations within PowerDNS. And you can do that remotely. So that means that those folks have hooked up triggers to their web interface that when someone makes a change to a domain name, the PowerDNS instances get a message that says, remove this stuff from your cache because the database changed. So they are able to run at a 24-hour cache lifetime, but still serve fresh answers.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
And one of the things that kind of annoyed me about Bind was having to restart every time you made a change to your zone.
Yeah, that's the thing we explicitly decided to avoid. We never wanted to force anyone to do a restart except when you really change the configuration. But the other thing is, if you do a restart of PowerDNS, it takes 1 second. Because we don't have to read through all the zones on startup.
And you make a mistake, and then you have to restore the zone file.
Yeah, exactly. It's because we have a sort of philosophy that comes from RFC 1925, which is the 12 fundamental networking truths, which is the best RFC ever. And anyone should read it, print it out, RFC 1925. And it has a set of rules for network infrastructure, and I think rule number 2 is it has to work. and it's interesting that it needs to be set. Note explicitly that RFC 1925 does not say it has to be right. It says it has to work. And we have lots of solidarity with the people that are on call for 24 hours a day.
Yeah,
and we want the software to just work and be up. And if you make a mistake somewhere, so we have a limited number of mistakes where the name server will just not launch, but you really have to mess it up to make that happen. But as long as we know that we are able to serve data correctly, then we will do it. And that means indeed that if you make one mistake in a zone file, there is no centralized big configuration file, so it's tricky to the classic situation when with name servers going down is that someone put a semicolon in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of DNS is that it's so resilient that quite often people only notice that something is wrong when the last of the three name servers is down. And then when people look up, it turns out the other two had been down for months already, but no one knew. I would also like to comment a little bit on Bind and other name servers. We get along pretty well with everyone else. So we drink beer with the people from Bind and the people from NLNet Labs and other stuff, and we have our differences in our philosophy on how we write the software.
Mm-hmm.
But people often assume that we would be enemies with the Internet Software Corporation, and that is so incredibly not the case. We also try not to make fun of each other's securities mistakes because Bind recently had a very big one. And we make no fun of that because we know that one day we will have a very big security mistake. And it happens to everybody.
Sooner or later, there was further.
Okay. For regular people who are listening to this and think, hey, maybe it's a good idea to deploy some DNS for myself because I don't really trust my ISP or I think they're slow or whatever, is there any recommendation you can do for them?
We have very big users and we have very small users. Yeah. One of the things I like for the more regular user, and you still have to be a Unix geek. I mean, if you're not a Unix geek, then it's hard to take control of your own infrastructure. I think one of the nice small features we have in PowerDNS is if you run it as your recursor, we have a feature called export etc hosts, which means that with no real work, you can, if you have a printer with an IP address and you put that printer in /etc/hosts and you configure PowerDNS with export etc hosts, it will share that with your home network. So that means if you have a few IP addresses in your home that you just want to work, you don't need to set up an entire zone file. We will just make it will just work for you. And if you would do that, then at least you're no longer giving away the few percent of traffic that Google was not seeing yet, and you're also probably getting better performance.
So the receiver will be one that you'd run locally. It's like the cache.
Yeah, it's the cache.
Okay. So now it runs on an ARM processor, so technically it would run on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, it would. That's also the main reason I think it's getting fixed. We would love to be able to do that. Just have a little name server brick that just does its thing.
And hypothetically, you were saying that you run it on what DNS server again? Sorry, my brain is fried in this heat. You use SQLite, which runs very nicely on Raspberry Pi.
Yeah. So you could have this little name server brick and everything on there. And
could you run your own .hacker domain outside of the whole infrastructure? And then
yeah, you can. And people do that kind of stuff a lot. But the interesting thing is, so people do that. Yeah, you can, and it's nice and it's fun to do it. But here's the interesting thing. If you look at the root name servers, which are at the core of the DNS of the phone book, 95% of the queries they get are for domains like .hacker and .printer and .corp and .office and whatever.
Yeah.
And these are these sort of internal queries that leak out to the internet. And they're leaking out at such a rate that now 95% of the traffic at the DNS root servers has nothing to do with the internet.
Okay, well, and those queries would have been resolved by everybody else.
They should have been. They should never have left the office.
Yeah, exactly. But when they do get out, they have to keep going up to the very root because nobody else knows about them.
No, no. And then the root says, well, I don't know about .corp. and a dot printer. And that's actually a very ongoing discussion right now, because there are these top-level domains like .com and .net and .gov, and those, there are now thousands of new ones being pondered. And they will be handed out maybe this year, maybe next year, I don't know. But some of them that are being discussed for handing out are ones that people might have been using internally.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you were leaking queries for .corp or whatever, and suddenly .corp starts to exist. And maybe your printer that has been trying to report its status to central server .corp will suddenly start reporting its status to a server in Russia or whatever. So, you can run your own domain names, but they always tend to leak and get out. So, be careful with that. Well, I would, these days I would actually recommend just get a real domain name and just use that one.
Yeah.
Because that will at least always end up at your servers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm also thinking about, you wanted to build your own network, and you wanted, you know, for privacy issues, you wanted to keep your own network running, and a federation of friends, for example.
Yep.
That you just brought up your own DNS.
It is done. People do it. And these are called sort of alternate routes, where people say, well, we have our own DNS infrastructure. The issue with that is that it's incredibly, it's very exclusionary when you do that. DNS is really one. You either on board with the alternate route or you're on board with the normal route.
Yeah.
And it's there are these organizations do exist that have defined their own internet, but they're very lonely people.
Okay.
Because once you get on board with their vision on the internet, suddenly other parts of the internet disappear, and or you have websites that work for you and for no one else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's typically tremendously hard to have distributed, fully decentralized naming. Naming is really implicitly a hierarchical thing.
I'm just wondering, you know, back in the day there were zone files being passed, you know, host files being passed around, and then they become zone files, and then DNS developed. You know, with the advent of BitTorrent or something like that, could you send like a terabyte file with all the DNS records from everywhere in it?
People have been trying real hard to apply crypto principles to enable fully distributed and totally uncontrolled decentralized naming. And the most advanced one of that is Namecoin, which is related to Bitcoin technologies. And from a philosophical standpoint, I think they've come the furthest in because, and I'm not a Namecoin expert, to be honest, but the one thing they got right is, if you, let's start naively with, so let's say we three band together and we start a list of all domain names.
Yeah, good plan.
And then we put on there that ohm2013.org is hosted by the NSA. And then someone else says, no, that's not true. It's hosted by Ifcat and whatever. And then as the casual internet user, you wouldn't know who to trust. You never know if the IP address you got is from one political faction or for the other.
Yeah.
What the Namecoin people did, the Namecoin people made it sure that you need to invest in your name. You need to spend serious clock cycles on defending your name. And that means that, and every time people use it, it becomes sort of more embedded. So they solve the decentralized federated naming issue with proof of work statements. And that means that the one that has been claiming that ohm2013.org is his domain for the longest time, because they have the oldest proof of work, they can say, well, I have a valid claim to it. But it's still incredibly messy. And like I said, the DNS is like the sewer of the internet. You want it to work, or you're covered in shit. And that's the same stuff with the federated naming. People have very little patience for DNS that is more secure but doesn't actually work.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I would typically recommend to get your security at a higher level than DNS.
Okay, if you were doing DNS too, what would you do properly? Carte blanche. You can do whatever you want.
I would do
any amount of money.
One of the oddest things about DNS is that DNS has no way of saying there is no answer to your question. So if you say, give me the IP address for www.ohm2014.org, the answer to that is empty. There is no answer. It gives you an empty answer. That means there are no answers. When you try to do crypto based on that, you need to sign this empty answer. The problem is all the empty answers are identical.
Yes.
So that's why the DNS specification, the DNSSEC specification is now bigger than the DNS specification. So we have an enhancement that is bigger than the original to work around this issue. The first thing I would do would be to have a DNS that can just say, I now authoritatively state that this domain name does not exist. And then you could sign that one,
yeah,
for example. The other big thing I would...
Just to put in, that would help me troubleshooting DNS issues, because then you'll...
Yeah, you would actually say, oh, it says here. Because right now we hacked that in. Actually, originally DNS really didn't have a way of saying it really doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And then it was hacked in that there's a little trick you do that in the DNS answer you put another record, and then you derive from the presence of that other record that there really is no such domain.
Okay, fair enough.
But there was a trick, and everyone knows it's a trick. And so that's the first thing I would definitely change. The interesting thing is that I met with the original inventor of DNS, Paul Mokopetris.
Mm-hmm.
And he works in France these days, and he's a really interesting guy. And he explained how the internet was really designed and how it worked. And he told me that when they came up with DNS, he got a question from John Postel.
I'm sorry to have to interrupt here, but we have a problem with the tent. We have to get everybody out. So we'll be on music for a while the problems with the tent are getting sorted. So sorry about that.
No problem.
Bye. Okay, well, we're going to evacuate and... maybe we'll finish this later.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.